Welcome to Simple Living Works, episodes 72 and 73. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, John Seeger, President and CEO of Population Connection in Washington, D.C. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. In this two-part conversation, John and I talk first about the history of Population Connection, its philosophy, programs, and funding. In part two, we talk about more topics related to population, such as the different policies of China and India, immigration, and much more. Since 1968, Population Connection, formerly Zero Population Growth, or ZPG, has been America's voice for population stabilization, the largest grassroots population organization in the United States, with over 40,000 members and hundreds of thousands more supporters and participating educators. Population Connection advocates for universal, affordable access to birth control, educates today's leaders about global population challenges, and mobilizes Americans who care about stabilizing population. They strive to achieve a sustainable balance between people and our planet. If you're wondering, what does population have to do with simple living? I hope this two-part conversation will answer that question. For more information, visit populationconnection.org.
Please give us a brief history of Population Connection.
Well, I'd be glad to do so. As you noted, we were founded in 1968. Back then, a professor then, and I might note now, at Stanford named Paul Ehrlich, who was an entomologist and still is, a bug expert, if you will, wrote a fairly slim volume called The Population Bomb. Now, a lot of books get written every year, and most of them don't get wide circulation. So one might think that would be the case with a book by a bug expert about human population growth. Well, it sold over 2 million copies, which is extraordinary. It was, to use an analogy, the inconvenient truth of its day, to cite the name of Al Gore's film. It caught on and sparked interest, especially on college campuses all across America. And perhaps we can get into why it happened when it happened, because I think that's very relevant. But what happened as a consequence of it was there was no organization. There was all this interest. So our organization, Zero Population Growth, sprung into being to serve that interest. And the issue has evolved, and our name has changed over the years, but one fact still remains, and namely that is that human population growth is one of the great challenges facing our time.
Well, now, why was the name changed? Zero Population Growth sounds quite specific, but Population Connection sounds a bit vague.
I would agree with you. It was specific. I would also note that it isn't necessarily the goal. I think that the world, by almost any reasonable measure, is today overpopulated, and if we did achieve zero population growth at some point down the road, that would not mean that we've necessarily met the population challenge. The other reason, though, was that the name carried with it, I think, over time, particularly for people who weren't familiar with sort of the era, a certain sense that we were a group that was out to tell other people what to do, that we were professional finger waggers, and we're not. We're not here to tell anybody how many children to have. That's a private matter, and there should be a huge keep-out sign posted over that. What we've come to understand is that you have to look at the population issue in a broader context, and that's where the connection part comes in. You have to look at it in the context of social justice, first and foremost, and if you can't get that right, there's nothing else to be done. But beyond that, you have to look at its relationship to poverty, to climate change, to species extinction, to civil strife, and work through some pretty complex relationships. And so it seemed appropriate about 12 years ago, and our volunteer board decided to move forward on it, to change the name. And the new name actually came from our own members. When we asked them, why do you care about the population issue? What they told us time and again was because it was connected to other things that they cared about, such as the things I mentioned a moment ago.
It looks like you have three or four major programs going on. Can you tell us a little bit about those, please?
Yes, we have, depending on how you look at it, two or three programs. It just depends on how you frame it. The two external programs, if you will, are our population education program. We have the best and only, really, nationwide population education program. It operates K through 12. We train about 11,000 teachers here in the United States every year and produce a curriculum that relates to it. Our goal with that program is not to tell students what to think about population. Our goal is to get students, through the good work of their teachers, to think about population issues and to consider the implications for them both personally and globally. And we do that through a variety of hands-on activities. And we work very closely to make sure that our programs fit the criteria that teachers have to follow in each and every state. So there are about 3 million students around the year that use our, around the country each year that use our programs. That's our first program, population education. The second focus we have is advocacy. We advocate primarily for international family planning, not because the domestic side isn't equally important, but because there are other wonderful organizations that we work with, such as Planned Parenthood, who do focus on that. Our goal is to try to specifically meet the need of the 225 million women around the world who already want to limit their family size or not have any more children for some period of time, but face all sorts of barriers that are in the way of enabling them to do what they want to do. And that's our focus on the advocacy side. The third part of what we do is that we are the gathering point for about 500,000 Americans who care about population growth and who support progressive approaches to meet those challenges. And anybody who'd like to add one more to that number is welcome to do so by going to our website, populationconnection.org, and click on it and become part of our group.
Well, now, in addition to individual donations, how is Population Connection funded? And are there any other ways that we concerned citizens can get involved with your programs?
In terms of funding, we do not accept, nor do we seek, nor do we want, nor would we accept any governmental or quasi-governmental funding. We prefer to be independent. We prefer to be able to follow our own mission without having to look over our shoulders at some public governmental funder. So all of our funds, for all practical purposes, come from our donors. There's really no other source of funds. We get a little bit in publication sales, but essentially our funding is those 40,000 people around the country who care about our issue and who decide on their own to support it. In terms of the ways people can be involved, they certainly can join our organization and make a donation. They can go to our website and they can look at different information. They can do their own work if they want to in terms of being citizen advocates for some of the things that we support. We try to provide a broad resource for people. Essentially, our focus is at the federal level rather than at the state level, because what we're trying to do on the advocacy side is to get Congress to appropriate more money for international family planning and to eliminate a wide array of restrictions that have been put on those funds over the years.
I think those restrictions have been called gag rules.
Well, the global gag rule is one such restriction, and it gets put on, at least historically speaking, every time we elect a Republican president, Reagan and the two Bushes, going back in time. The global gag rule has been put in place, and when Democrats have been elected, in the case of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, it's been removed. And what the global gag rule says is that if an organization working in another country to provide family planning either performs or in any way engages in discussion around abortion, not with U.S. funds, because that's not allowed, but with their own money, with other money that they get, then they are barred from getting any U.S. funds for family planning. Again, the United States government does not provide funding around the world for abortion services, but essentially the gag rule says, we're not going to give you any money to do family planning if you either perform abortions or even if you provide advice upon request to a local government on these issues. So that's what the gag rule is. There are other restrictions as well that come and go, and some are in place right now. All of them are intended to restrict the flow of reproductive health services to women around the world by people who don't support them.
Well, you have a new publication called The Good Crisis, How Population Stabilization Can Foster a Healthy U.S. Economy. Now, that sounds a little counterintuitive. I thought we needed more and more young people to pay for Social Security and Medicare for us elders.
Well, if we look here in the United States, first of all, I have not personally noticed a great people shortage as I drive around the country. Particularly at rush hour, there seem to be quite a few people out and about. And in fact, America is not suffering from a shortage of people. The average American, and it ebbs and flows a bit, but the average American couple has about two children. We're a bit below that right now, but it shifts a little bit with time. And if you think about it, it's pretty simple. A couple, two people have two kids. Essentially, they're replacing themselves. So we're not looking at the possibility of population decline at any point in the foreseeable future here in the United States. What is true is that the ratio of people who are in what are generally considered their working years as compared with those who in what are generally considered the retirement years is shifting in what you might call an adverse direction. That is to say, there are fewer workers per retiree. And that raises a question, and let's look at Social Security for a moment. Who's going to pay for it? Well, there are two key things to keep in mind here. First of all, it is true that if you look out several decades, there will be a shortfall in Social Security funds. That is to say, Social Security will not be taking in enough money going out several decades to cover 100% of benefits. You could solve that problem by doing one very simple thing. That is taking the cap off the Social Security tax for high earners. People who earn $118,000 or less, and that's the vast majority of Americans, pay Social Security on all of their earned income. People who are lucky enough to earn more than that do not. So the woman, and yes, it is usually a woman, who cleans the corner office pays a higher Social Security tax rate than the man, usually a man, who occupies that office. That just doesn't seem fair. Why not have a simple flat tax on Social Security? Everybody pays the same rate. If you do that, that shortfall essentially vanishes. The other issue to look at here is that the key ratio is not the ratio between workers and retirees. It's the ratio between workers and dependents. Now, it costs a lot to raise young people. Anybody who's been a parent or who knows about that subject would readily agree with that. Americans are having smaller families than they used to have. That means that we need fewer elementary schools, fewer pediatricians. That offsets the need for more gerontologists and more retirement communities. The reason we call this the good crisis is because there are so many people who wring their hands and say, oh, this is a crisis, this move toward population stabilization. Our point of view is that if it is a crisis, it's the first good one we've ever had in about time.
Thank you, John. We in the voluntary simplicity movement have for decades been promoting the idea that consumption is a greater problem in the U.S. than population. For example, people in the U.S. use five times more of the Earth's resources and produce five times more waste than people in Mexico. Likewise, we use 30 times what a typical person in India uses. That's why we dare not promote U.S. lifestyle around the globe. If all 7 billion of us on Earth lived like we do here in the U.S., it would take 5 Earths to support us. Now, some call this view, our view, racist, that they think that everybody everywhere should have the privilege of overconsuming. Now, some say that we need to deal with our consumption problem here and not worry about people in other countries. However, we're all connected by environmental factors such as weather and also economic factors such as trade. So how does population connection view the dilemma between population and consumption?
About 40 years ago, two scientists, one of which was Paul Ehrlich, whom I mentioned before, who wrote the book The Population Bomb, and the other one, a gentleman named John Holdren, who is now the White House science advisor for the Obama administration, came up with a very simple but remarkably useful formula. I equals P times A times T. Impact, that is to say environmental impact, equals population times affluence times technology. As population grows, the impact on the environment grows. At least to date, as people become more affluent, the impact on the environment tends to grow. I say tends to grow because I keep hoping, as an optimist, that we'll see signs that that curve bends at some point, that at some point people just don't want more stuff. Speaking personally, I don't want more stuff. There isn't a thing in the world that I want. My wife and I spend more time trying to figure out how to get rid of stuff, as we did this weekend, taking a number of things down to a local place that is able to find a market for them and uses the money to help people in need, a thrift shop, then we do getting stuff. It's really not any stuff we want. So maybe the affluence curve will bend, maybe it won't. The third piece of that IPAT equation is technology. Technology can work in either direction. It just depends. If you buy a gigantic SUV, which is certainly technology, then your impact on the environment is increasing. If you buy a hybrid car, perhaps it decreases. Depends, but perhaps it does. So technology is kind of the X factor in here, if you will. It can work in either direction. Now, looking more broadly, it's really not a question, when you get right down to it, of whether we want people around the world to have the American lifestyle. Quite frankly, I can't imagine why they would care one way or the other about what we want. They look at what we have, and they say, well, if this is so terrible, why do all these people who have money have this stuff? The plain fact is that there is nothing we can do directly to prevent people from wanting what we have unless we sort of try to develop some kind of regime of permanent poverty for people in other countries, which seems like a bad idea on a number of levels. What we need to do is work on both sides of this, if you will, or all three sides. Number one, we need to address the challenges of population growth through voluntary means. If those 225 million women that I mentioned previously had their needs for contraception met, the world would achieve replacement rate fertility, and eventually that would lead to population stabilization. So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it, and it's not what we work on, not because it isn't important, it's just because if you try to do everything, you get nothing done, is to work on the vast array of approaches to try to reduce the impact, particularly of fossil fuels, but many other things as well, so that people, as in other countries, as they become more affluent, have better options that are less heavy in terms of consumption impact. And the final thing that we can work on, and it's a bit more abstract because nobody really has a pathway toward it, although the voluntary simplicity movement is certainly working in that direction, is to try to encourage people to think about the fact that if you are fortunate enough to be more affluent, maybe you don't want more stuff. Do you really want to spend your time, and time is the one resource that is limited in this world, sorting through all your stuff? Or would you rather do something that's perhaps a little more interesting? So those are different pieces of the equation. They all matter. It just happens that we work on one of them.
Thank you, John. Thank you, John. We deal with advertising, for example, and the means of marketing all of our products, you know, around the world, and in trade agreements that make it more tempting for people around the world to adopt an American lifestyle. So that's what I was getting at.
You've been listening to my conversation with John Seeger, President and CEO of Population Connection, formerly known as Zero Population Growth. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com or on our Facebook page or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. To read the latest responses to all Simple Living Works media, including our new daily Simpler Living Nudge, click the link in the show notes or click your recent comments in window number 5 at simplelivingworks.org. Time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works and would like more basic information, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will now through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want, with or without show notes. Subscription to this podcast and to our weekly blog are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on the show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Sharealike License. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive way of life. It's not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everybody's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the 5 life standards of living more with less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed these standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The 3 parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video, and links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.